WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to hear an insider's perspective on the news business from two people who are particularly well-equipped to give it. My guests are Leonard Downey Jr., executive editor of The Washington Post, and Robert G. Kaiser, associate editor and senior correspondent. They've worked together since 1964 when they were interns at the Post. They were both reporters and foreign correspondents before becoming editors. They've collaborated on the new book, The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. Let's start with the press and the war against terrorism. Downey and Kaiser say that the press has been up against serious obstacles in covering the war because the military and the CIA have been trying to conduct a secret war and have been antagonistic toward deep press coverage, and that's making it riskier for reporters. I asked Downey and Kaiser if they think the Bush administration needs to be this secretive to wage the war effectively, or whether the reasons are perhaps more self-serving.
It does seem to us that the Bush administration wants to conduct this war like a little private party and really doesn't have any compelling sense that there's a public's need to know much at all. There was an agreement, you may remember, after the Gulf War, signed in 92 between the Pentagon and news organizations about how to cover future military operations. The Bush administration has simply disregarded that in this episode.
What kind of access would that have given you that you feel you're not getting?
Well, it was designed for a recurrence of the Gulf War more than for this war, so you can't say enumerate a specific list, I don't think. But the spirit of it was that as soon as possible, the military would invite reporters on operations, would make room for reporters on military flights, would, you know, make access possible for the maximum number of reporters as fast as possible. And that just didn't happen. The big things in this war were never opened up. For example, the Kitty Hawk, which was the carrier that was the base for the special forces and the CIA groups, was off limits to reporters the entire duration of its stationing in the sea out there. I forgot the Indian Ocean, I guess. Other things were just blocked off. The base in Uzbekistan was blocked off for all but one brief visit when Rumsfeld himself went there, and so on. So they just haven't had a spirit of letting the war be covered openly in any way.
And how do you think that the secrecy within the Bush administration is compromising the safety of your reporters?
Because they have do not have military escorts or been able to be embedded with U.S. troops, they obviously have no physical protection from U.S. troops whatsoever. And in fact, many of the CIA operatives and special forces people try to keep reporters at a distance away from them. So there's absolutely no protection from American authorities of any kind. So they've had to be on their own, which is not, you know, we can't complain about that. That's often the case now in this world where an awful lot of ethnic conflicts are going on across the globe. Foreign correspondents are increasingly at risk of being caught in the crossfire of those wars or being victimized by banditry, and that's those are exactly the risks that have been taken in Afghanistan, where so far more correspondents have been killed in this war than have been American forces by hostile fire.
Well, we just recently learned about the execution of Danny Pearl. I'm wondering if you're giving any advice now to your overseas reporters about being more cautious. If the execution of Daniel Pearl, if his kidnapping and execution affected the kind of advice you're giving your foreign reporters about their own safety.
Yes. In fact, right from the beginning, we knew this was a dangerous situation over there for the reasons that I cited. And so we sent in, by and large, only correspondents who had been experienced in these kinds of wars before and or people who could be accompany more experienced reporters until they learned the ropes. But after the kidnapping of Daniel Pearl, we made some specific rules for our reporters. We've left them all in the region. They're continuing to do their work. We haven't pulled anybody out. But they are supposed to observe rules about traveling in groups and other things to protect their safety.
Can you tell us about some of those rules?
One of them, for instance, is to not go off on your own when it's not necessary. and to keep their colleagues as well as the Home Office apprised of their whereabouts at all times. Fortunately, one of the great technological advantages in this war is the satellite phone, which enables us to speak with our correspondents wherever they are and for them to call us from wherever they are. And that's actually proved helpful in several situations where correspondents either felt lost in the chaos of the war or feared for their safety. And we were able to assist them by talking with them over the satellite phone and helping them take steps to protect themselves.
Can you give us an example of what kind of assistance you could give by satellite phone from Washington that could help an imperiled reporter in Afghanistan?
Shortly after the Northern Alliance succeeded in taking some of the towns in the north, in the celebrations that occurred afterwards, there was a lot of lawlessness. And in at least one case, one of our correspondents felt that she was in great danger there and was actually hiding out in the town to escape the gunfire and chaos going on in the streets, was able to contact us by satellite phone, and we were able to provide assistance with another one of our correspondents to help her leave that town.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Leonard Downey Jr., executive editor of The Washington Post, and Robert G. Kaiser, associate editor and roving correspondent at The Post. They're the authors of the new book, The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. The New York Times was recently leaked a Pentagon memo saying that the Pentagon was starting a special office for foreign news that would distribute both real news and disinformation to foreign news sources for the purposes of shaping public opinion and the opinion of policymakers around the world. After that memo was leaked to the Times, Donald Rumsfeld said, well, he wasn't really aware of it. This doesn't sound like a very good idea. And now this office is closed. What do you think of how the Times handled that leaked memo, and what does the impact of that say to you about journalism?
Well, they handled it very well. It was a very good story. We envied it. Happily, we've left them a lot to envy as well in the last few months. But this is a very good example of the power of journalism. Information is the power here. What had to happen was the world had to find out that this cockamamie idea was in somebody's head in the Pentagon. And as soon as it became known, really, there was almost unanimous condemnation of it from Congress, from editorial writers, from all over the place, and from Donald Rumsfeld, who genuinely did seem surprised. I don't know whether to credit that or not. It doesn't matter. But in fact, as soon as the intention was clear, the idea collapsed.
What impact would it have on you if there was a Pentagon office that was knowingly giving out false information, spreading disinformation to foreign news sources?
It would obviously make our jobs more difficult. People would not necessarily believe our reporters were acting independently of the government. It obviously would be spreading disinformation that we would then have to check out to see what was true and what was not true. It's really not a very good idea for the government to be engaged in that sort of thing.
But most important, Terry, I think it would mean that we wouldn't be able to take anything seriously the Pentagon ever said again.
Have you been in a situation yet since September 11th where you wanted to publish something and the government has asked you not to for purposes of security?
There have been several instances in which, as we've gone about our reporting of various matters, usually having to do with intelligence operations, when the government, once they have knowledge that we're doing this reporting, have raised questions about whether or not publishing some very specific information within a story would damage national security. And we have agreed in three or four instances not to withhold stories entirely. We've published the stories, but to leave out of those stories very specific, usually technical information about methods of surveillance, for example, or electronic eavesdropping, or the exact locations of covert operations that probably would endanger American lives. And we do not want to do that.
Now, how does the government know in the first place that you have this information? Do you call up a Pentagon official and say, look?
No.
Yeah, right.
No, we don't do that. No, what happens is that as our reporters do their reporting, they're obviously asking questions about the information they're gathering. Mm-hmm. And that automatically brings it to the attention of people in the chain of command.
And so you get the call from somebody in the Pentagon saying,
yes,
hey, don't go with this fact.
It can be the Pentagon, the CIA, the White House, a variety of places, and sometimes it's just it's initiated with the reporter, and then they will pass it up to their editors.
And do you have a meeting about that, or does like one editor usually make the decision?
We have discussions, sometimes lengthy discussions, if it's necessary, before making the decision, and the final decision is mine.
My guests are Leonard Downey Jr., executive editor of The Washington Post, and Robert G. Kaiser, associate editor. Their new book is called The News About the News. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Leonard Downey Jr., who is executive editor of The Washington Post, and Robert G. Kaiser, associate editor and roving correspondent at The Post. They've written a new book called The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. I'd like to ask you to choose an investigative story at The Post that you're very proud of. You can use an example from the book or another one if you please.
We'd choose, I think, the 1998 series on shootings of civilians on the streets of Washington by the D.C. Police Department, which we describe at considerable length in The News About the News.
Yeah, and this is a story about how there were more shootings of civilians in Washington, maybe almost twice as much as in most comparable cities. What was the investigation about? Why did you initiate the story?
It's a wonderful example of how investigative reporting really works. A database editor, as she was called, funny new title in journalism, was familiar with an FBI crime reporting system that she'd done some work on, computer work on in the past. And her previous work had convinced her that there was a category of shootings that looked like something suspicious. And she took it to the editors of the Washington Post investigative reporting team, and they started to talk about it and think about it. To make a long story very short, decided that there was something here worth pursuing. And they discovered that, indeed, the FBI had been collecting statistics on the number of times citizens were killed by police shootings. An enormous amount of effort and sometimes lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act and other maneuvers slowly elicited the gory details. They found that numerous families had sued the Washington police over the deaths of their family members, which they considered unwarranted and things of that kind. And over many months, they pieced together an enormously elaborate jigsaw puzzle, which showed the extent of these police shootings.
What do you think the story accomplished?
Well, this is one of those lovely occasions when you can say emphatically that it accomplished an enormous amount, because I don't have the numbers in my head now, but whereas there were like in something like 39 people killed in the last year that was the subject of the investigation, by last year or 2000 it was down to 7. The police department here retrained every member of the force. They had new training both in when to shoot and how to shoot. And went through elaborate changes. There's an interesting story in the recent Washington Post just the other day showing that the numbers snuck up a little bit in 2001, but it's still way below the level that we exposed in the original series. So this is a really nice case where we literally saved lives by publishing this material.
And was the story very expensive or very time-consuming?
It was enormously time-consuming. It probably consumed 3 or 4 man years, maybe 5 or 6 even, if you think of everybody involved. Man and woman years, but the expense of it beyond the salaries of the people on the job and the usual expenses of gathering news and probably some legal fees for the FOIA, Freedom of Information Act lawsuits, they were not extensive. It was in our backyard. We didn't have to travel far, so it was just a question of paying the salaries and the expenses of everybody involved in the case.
Which is the kind of commitment to what we call accountability reporting that's so important in American journalism. And when we see newsrooms being shrunk at newspapers and the television networks and local television stations in order to increase profits, we realize that this is the kind of reporting that will usually be squeezed out because it did require devoting 6 or 7 people to the story exclusively, not doing anything else for a year's time. And you can't do that if you don't have a large enough newsroom.
Well, did you have to justify the expense of this to your publisher?
No, not at all. I get an annual budget to run the newsroom, and I make all the decisions after that about how we allocate our resources, number one. Number two, both our publisher, Bo Jones, and the CEO of the Washington Post, Donald Graham, believe this is the kind of journalism that's important to be doing as a public service to our community.
In your book, you include a story that you think the Washington Post didn't do well at. You say, with this story, you failed as watchdogs, allowing President Reagan and his associates to abuse their power and the Constitution. And this is an Iran-Contra story. The story begins on October of 1986 when Sandinista soldiers in Nicaragua shot down a cargo plane with four men, three of them Americans. The only survivor was a soldier of fortune named Eugene Hassenfuss. Take the story from there.
The story actually began before then, because before that plane crash, the Reagan administration, had, through the efforts of a National Security Council aide named Oliver North, had been illegally, and contrary to what Congress had written in law, illegally using the proceeds from the sales of arms to Iran to finance the activities of the Contra rebels in Latin America. And this had been going on for some time, and the media had not cracked the case at all. So when Hassenfuss's plane crashed, we saw some glimmerings of what might be going on there, and I worked hard to try to get the newsroom energized to chase the story. And Bob Kaiser, who was then the assistant managing editor in charge of national news, actually sent out a bunch of reporters, both here and abroad, to try to crack the story. But we really didn't weren't able to say what was really going on until a small newspaper in Lebanon was able to first reveal the sales of arms to Iran in exchange for the release of American hostages there. And then when that created a firestorm in Washington, it was the Reagan administration itself, Attorney General Edwin Meese, who first revealed the diversion of these funds to the Contras.
So
Terry, that the sins that were committed here, the bad stuff that was going on, had gone on for well over a year before the airplane crashed, and we had missed it entirely. It was right under our noses, and we didn't see it.
But when the airplane crashed, that was the first clue you had that something was really going on, because Hassenfuss said he thought he was working for the CIA.
Correct.
In retrospect, what do you think you could have done in investigating this plane crash that might have led you sooner to the Iran-Contra scandal?
Well, it would have been before the plane crash. And in fact, we did have some whiffs of it. We described this episode in the book. You knew that North was up to something funny. We wrote about North. North had made a kind of bizarre attempt to keep his name out of the Washington Post and the New York Times on the grounds that somehow his life was in danger if his name was mentioned. That got our hackles up. There was whiffs in the air of strange things going on. But we just had no idea of the boldness of the operations that North was trying to run here. And it would have been months earlier that we'd have gotten some clue about these secret missions to Tehran. You remember the crazy thing with the cake for the Ayatollah and all that stuff was going on. That's what I'm talking about, the stuff we missed that we didn't know.
Right.
And the fact is, you know, we're not infallible by any means. We miss stories. And it's sometimes, as in the case of the Hassenfuss plane crash, just dumb luck that these things come unraveled. And one of the interesting subjects that Len and I talk about privately over the years is, what are we missing? What have we missed completely? You know, there are going to be more surprises. Books will be written. Memoirs will be disclosed. Memories will be disclosed, I should say. And it happens all the time. There's just no way that reporters in this day and age can find out everything that's going on, I don't think.
It's again a reminder, though, that this kind of accountability reporting, holding the government accountable to the people, takes an awful lot of time, effort, and determination. This is very hard work, because a number of people in that administration lied to us about this, just as goes on in every administration, Democratic or Republican. If they're doing something they want to hide from the American people, they will lie to the media about it. They'll take advantage of their relationships with reporters they know. So it takes an enormous amount of work to get around behind the scenes and discover what's really going on.
Now, in your book, you explain that there was a point where you were ready to say that Oliver North was implicated in these wrongdoings, but you were asked by the Reagan administration not to name him. Who asked you? What reason did they give?
A White House official asked me and said that he was concerned that having his name in the paper would risk his life.
North was concerned.
Yes, we do not knowingly publish things in the newspaper when we think it really will endanger somebody's life. But what I insisted on was talking to Oliver North himself, which I did. And he was not able to convince me that there was any real danger of his life of having him as a public official named in the newspapers. We always name public officials, and we went ahead and used his name.
Oh, so you did go ahead and use it?
Yes, we did.
It must be a really strange position to be able to say, no, I don't think you're really in danger, so I'm going to go ahead and publish your name, because say he's right, say he really is in danger, and someone in his, or say someone in his family is killed. I mean, that would be on your head.
Luckily,
for publishing.
Luckily, it's never
it.
Happened.
Yeah, right. But it must be really hard to call somebody's bluff in a situation where so much could be at stake.
This is the nature of editing a newspaper or running a television news operation, in that somebody needs to make the final decisions about what goes in the paper, what goes on the air, and what doesn't. We have a finite amount of space in the newspaper, so we decide on the basis of relevance, for instance, what's going to go in the paper. But we also have to make these kinds of decisions about safety and about national security, and somebody has to make the decision. We do our best to consult widely so that we make informed decisions. I've had a lot of experience doing this over the years, and I could tell that at that time, Mr. North was not straight with me.
Leonard Downey Jr. is the executive editor of The Washington Post. Robert G. Kaiser is the paper's associate editor. They'll be back in the second half of their show. Their new book is called The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Leonard Downey Jr., executive editor of The Washington Post, and Robert G. Kaiser, the Post's associate editor. They've written a new book called The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. When we left off, we were talking about a story where they think they failed to be good watchdogs, the Iran-Contra story. You were lied to many times by the Reagan administration about Iran-Contra. What impact does it have on you as journalists when you're lied to by the very top?
Well, you know, we've been lied to by every administration. Len and I have been at the Washington Post from Johnson through Bush, too, and I don't think any of them could have pristine records on this issue. It's what happens. Politicians get caught with their fingers in the cookie jar, and they don't want to fess up to it. And so, you know, we are very skeptical about official assertions. We don't tend to take them at face value. We tend to question and probe, because all of our life experiences over four decades have taught us that that's what's justified.
Well, you were both at the Washington Post during Watergate. How directly did you each work on Watergate?
I was the Moscow correspondent, so I wasn't
not
too
directly
involved.
I was one of the editors editing the coverage of Watergate. First, the coverage of the hearings by a reporter named Larry Meyer. And later on, I took over the editing of Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein.
What's the most difficult editorial decision you had to make on Watergate?
Being right every single time we published a story, because we knew what the risks were if we made a mistake, since for the longest time we were alone in the story. And even when we had competition later on from others in the media, the Nixon administration was putting such pressure to try to stop our reporting. And would have jumped on any mistake that we made. So that the pressure to be right was extraordinary.
So you were fact-checking and double fact-checking?
Oh, yes, and constantly, you know, going through every story with a fine-tooth comb, questioning every assertion made in it for hours at a time, every single day.
Now, you were lied to, of course, by the Nixon administration during Watergate. What are some of the lessons you learned from Watergate about covering presidents?
Well, you know, the lessons really did begin earlier, as Bob alluded to, with Vietnam. That was when, you know, the government first lying to the press and to the American people really became an issue, I think, for the media, and really began to change the media's approach to coverage of government. And then Watergate only heightened it. I think ever since then, there has been this really strong skepticism that Bob talked about assertions by any administration. Sometimes it takes on a kind of frivolous nature if you watch the White House briefings for the press every day. They're skeptical about everything the president's press secretary says, even rather mundane matters. But it also is very useful, for instance, in covering the secret war, to be sure that what the Pentagon is telling us is really true by sending reporters out on the ground at great peril to their lives to find out what's really happening.
I want to get to another example that you write about in your new book. And this is the controversy over whether to cover the private lives of presidential candidates. And this came up for you during the presidential campaign between Bob Dole and Bill Clinton. The Post learned about Bob Dole's 1971 divorce and the fact that he had an affair before the divorce. I guess I should say the Post learned about how Bob Dole handled that 1971 divorce. Tell us what you learned and what the controversy was within the Post about whether or not to publish this.
What happened was we published a story by Kevin Merida about the divorce. This Bob Dole's first wife was a nurse who had cared for him and brought him back to life after his terrible war wounds late in World War II. They got married. She supported him, took notes for him through law school, took care of him. They were very close for many years. They had a daughter together. But the marriage seemed to dry up somewhat. And one fine day, Dole came home and announced to the amazement of his wife that they were getting a divorce. And she should rush out to Kansas immediately and sign the papers and go to this place and that place, and everything would be taken care of at once. And he'd kind of greased the wheels in Kansas to make this divorce very easy and very quick. She was shocked and amazed, went through the motions, got the divorce. And Kevin learned about this in the course of a profile about Dole's personal life. And it seemed to us quite interesting. And we wrote a story about it. As soon as the story appeared, we started getting phone calls saying, well, you missed a big element of the story. He had a girlfriend. And it didn't take very long to establish that, yes, indeed, he had a young woman in Washington, young at the time, who with whom he had taken up and whose apartment he visited and been seen by neighbors visiting and so on. And before long, we had confirmed to our satisfaction that 27 years earlier, there had been such a love affair.
And then you had to then decide whether to publish the information
exactly
about that love affair.
What do you do with this? And in our book, we've shared the experience, or tried to. One of the purposes of this book is to help people understand how the news media work from the inside. And this was one of our inside examples. And luckily, we had a lot of written records. We had a lot of exchanges of memoranda on this issue. People led by me trying to persuade Len that because Dole and the Republicans were running against Bill Clinton on the implicit proposition that they were the moral alternative to an immoral president, that this was newsworthy and we ought to write the story, even though it didn't conform, obviously, with our general standards on the relevance of personal lives and personal peccadilloes. In the political context, I argued, and Bob Woodward argued, and others, this was a good story. And we argued back and forth about it over a period of weeks, as Bob Woodward ultimately and Chuck Babcock, the two reporters who were working on the story, and found the woman and interviewed her and got her on the record to talk about it. They kept offering different versions, rewriting, trying to figure out a way to couch it that seemed okay. And this went on for a couple of weeks or more, 4 weeks probably. The Dole campaign sent emissaries to us to try to convince us not to use the story. Went back and forth, and now I should let Leonard explain why he decided not to publish the story.
Take it, Leonard Downey.
Right. In making decisions about publishing information about the private lives of public officials, we have two criteria we need to meet. One is it true or not? Can we prove it? And secondly, is it relevant to their performance in public office or to their election campaigns? In this case, we were able to prove it was true. So that satisfied criteria number one. But criteria number two, I was never convinced that this was relevant to either Bob Dole's performance in public office during the 27 years that followed this affair, most of the time in which he was married to Elizabeth Dole in a marriage, as far as we know, with no blemishes whatsoever, or had anything to do with his fitness to be president of the United States, since all that time had passed since he had had this consensual affair. There also was no misuse of his office at the time. He was a congressman, but he wasn't using state troopers or government cars or any other way in which he was using his office either to conduct the affair or to keep it quiet. In fact, it was a consensual relationship that was well known to her friends and neighbors at the time. So it didn't seem to be any moral turpitude questions here outside his relationship with his wife that were relevant to his campaign for president. So in the end, I decided that we should not publish the story.
But what about the argument that it was still, you know, that the Republicans were still calling Clinton morally bankrupt, and yet, Bob Dole didn't really confer with his wife about the divorce. He had had an affair that he kept secret. I mean,
remember, we did publish a story about the divorce because our decision there
was true, right?
that was relevant because, among other things, he had used his political connections in Kansas in order to get a quickie divorce. So that was relevant to his conduct in office and was a different matter.
But the secret affair wasn't?
When you say secret, again, it wasn't something that had been made publicly known at the time or covered by the news media at the time, but it was also not something that was being conducted clandestinely. It was a relationship between two consenting adults 27 years before he was running for president.
In the book, there's an interesting memo from David Broder arguing that, in fact, Dole wasn't casting himself as the moral alternative, anything like the degree to which many Republicans wanted him to. And indeed, we had the feeling that once Dole knew that we knew about this affair, he ran away from that tack of argument very quickly and indeed didn't use it very much. So it's a muddy area. But it is because we have this written record, which we've shared in the book, anybody can judge this for themselves. They don't have to take our word for it, I think.
Robert Kaiser, are you happy with Leonard Downey's decision not to print the story about the affair?
I am, because... for two reasons. One, for more than two reasons. But interestingly... the story wasn't hidden from view because of Leonard's decision. 2 weeks later or less, the National Enquirer, of all distinguished newspapers, printed a very good story about this love affair, just as good as our story would have been, I think, in terms of the number of facts and confirmations they had on the record. And Dole himself had to respond to a question about the National Enquirer story posed, if I remember correctly, by a New York Daily News reporter in New York. And when that happened... here it was in the public domain, and Leonard and I together decided that we had to put something about it in the paper since we knew about it. So buried deep in a story in the Post the next day, we had a 3 or 4 paragraphs saying this had happened. Dole had made this statement about it. The Post actually had heard about this before and had investigated and confirmed that this affair occurred. And then we quoted Len in our own paper saying, but we decided we wouldn't publish the first story about this because it didn't meet the criteria that Len has just described. So if I might have had some residual bitterness, I doubt it, if the story had never come out, but it did come out. So on that count, I was pleased. But more importantly, I was pleased because I really believe in the system that prevails at the Washington Post, and I wish it prevailed at a lot more news organizations, which is another subject we write about in this book, but we are completely independent in making these decisions, but we are also a total dictatorship. The executive editor gets the last word, and in this case, he exercised the last word. But that tradition and that procedure is so beneficial to good journalism in so many other situations that it seems to me very foolish and short-sighted to get angry about it on those rare moments when the decision comes out in a way that one disagrees with. It's a great way to run an independent newspaper. There are very few in the country, unfortunately, run this way. We're very proud that we're one of them, and we want to preserve it.
My guests are Leonard Downey, Jr., executive editor of The Washington Post, and Robert G. Kaiser, associate editor. Their new book is called The News About the News. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Leonard Downey, Jr., executive editor of The Washington Post, and Robert G. Kaiser, associate editor and roving correspondent. They're the authors of the new book, The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. One of the reasons why you think American journalism is in peril is because of how the business end is almost trying to take over the priorities from the news end. You write about how the business end of newspaper publishing is changing. Large chains now own more than 1,200 of the nation's 1,500 dailies, you say. There's pressures to increase the profit. Sometimes the shareholders' interests are put ahead of news considerations. And you write, perhaps the most important change for editors is their incorporation into the business side of the papers. They're expected to do things that old-fashioned editors wouldn't have dreamed of. Like what?
Like go to the marketing meeting, like think up the next gimmick to try to increase circulation, like participate in the decision to start charging for the publication of obituary notices in the paper. All sorts of business decisions, which used to be completely the purview of the business side, now become part of the purview of the editor as well. And incidentally, this happens just as much in local television stations and in the national television networks as it does in newspapers.
And also have compensation tied to the profitability of the news organization, which means that the editor would have to think twice about publishing something in the paper that, for instance, might be very important for readers' protection, but would anger an advertiser who might withdraw their advertising, reduce the profitability of the paper, and cut the editor's compensation.
Now, are these kinds of circulation gimmicks problems at the Washington Post, or do you feel protected from that?
We're fabulously protected. We're really so fortunate. And one of our trepidations in writing this book is we know that all of our colleagues will secretly or openly say, oh, those guys are got such a fat deal there. Who are they to pass judgment on the rest of us? The Graham family, like the Sulzberger family that owns the New York or controls the New York Times, has this wonderfully generous attitude that the purpose of the paper, first of all, is public service, that the editors must be independent. We participate. I did when I was managing editor of the Post. Len does still in regular meetings with the business side. There's no reason not to be participants in the business. We need to make profits or we can't support our news organization. That's an important part of what we do. But we're not asked to do terrible things. And in our case, certainly, Len has an absolute veto over anything that the paper might consider doing that he considers a threat to the editorial integrity and independence of the Washington Post.
The news organizations that we studied where the news is getting better rather than worse are those in which the owners have emphasized that in addition to being profitable, they want their news organizations to serve the public interest. That's true of the Newhouse family, who are improving their newspapers, the McClatchy family, who have the controlling interest in that publicly held corporation and improve the newspapers that they buy, whereas the news organizations that are getting worse and producing worse journalism all the time are those where the owners have made clear that the bottom line is the most important thing. Even if it's necessary to compromise what the newsroom does or to greatly reduce newsroom resources to make more money, so be it. They will do so in order to keep their stock prices up.
Perhaps the most famous of the advertising tie-ins with editorial was the staple supplement at the Los Angeles Times. Since so much has been written about that and said about that already, let me ask you to choose another example of a place where the wall between editorial and advertising was penetrated in a way that you think diminished the credibility of the newspaper.
One that astounded me involves the local television station in Baltimore, whose call letters I'm going to forget. They're grateful to me for forgetting them. But this is a station that made a deal with Mercy Hospital in Baltimore to create segments on women's health in their local news programs, on which segments only staff of Mercy Hospital would appear. And every segment would include a plug for Mercy Hospital in one way or another. The segments themselves, evidently, were could be useful to women on health questions. They actually discussed serious subjects. But they were so loaded in Mercy Hospital's favor that over time, Baltimoreans got the impression that Mercy Hospital was a famous national institution, famous for its care of women. And indeed, in some polls that were taken of the Baltimore community, more people thought they should take a sick woman to Mercy Hospital than to Johns Hopkins, when in fact Johns Hopkins Hospital is regularly rated the best hospital in America, and it's right down the street in Baltimore. And the news director, or the general manager of this station, told me and has told other reporters, hey, there's nothing wrong with this. We don't turn anything over, any editorial control over to Mercy Hospital. These are all honest news segments. Our reporters ask the questions. There's nothing wrong with this. But it's just kind of Orwellian language to me because, in fact, the segment only exists because Mercy Hospital paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to the station. And because only Mercy Hospital people are used on the segments, of course, they are loaded. And apparently in local television, this is much more common than we at least understood. We have a long chapter about local television news, and it's many problems, but this was certainly the most horrific that we encountered, I think.
I want to emphasize, though, that we're even more concerned than advertiser influence about the simply the level of quality in overall news coverage, and too many news organizations where the greatest sin that the owners have committed is to so reduce their editorial resources and to so emphasize business goals rather than journalistic goals that they simply aren't covering the news well. And that's a much bigger problem than advertiser influence, as bad as advertiser influence is.
Leonard Downey Jr. is the executive editor of The Washington Post. Robert G. Kaiser is the paper's associate editor. Their new book is called The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. This is Fresh Air.